Okay, everyone. Hi. The date is day before Election Day, November 14th, 2022. And this is class number two on Zachariah Frankel and the Positive Historical School.
November 7th.
Yes, you're right. Sorry, I was my mind is on next week already because I'm going to Toronto. So I have that. That is correct. Thank you for the correction. I see Shacharis is still the same time tomorrow, though. I'm looking on my show calendar. We don't have any special times. Okay, so this is class number two. Just a few things from last class. I want to go back on a couple matters because I got a number of questions. So people didn't understand, perhaps I wasn't clear. Here's what the Shulchan Aruch about Kaparos. And this is the Shulchan Aruch as it looked, it appeared. I'm looking now in the Basic Etzfarim. A Shulchan Aruch appeared a few times in Rav Yosef Karo's lifetime. He dies in 1575, I think. So it appears once, twice, three times, four times in his lifetime. If you look in Tuf Reish Hay, it says the heading, Minhag Kaparos Berev Yom Kippuri, Minhag Shel Shtusu. It's a foolish practice. And in the text itself, he says that you should, he describes what Kaparos is, and then it says, Yeshlim Noah HaMinhagahu, you should avoid this practice. So what we spoke about last time is the heading written by Rav Yosef Karo. And people generally assume yes. Although I presented a proof that maybe it wasn't by him because of, we said, Sudashli Sheet. We said Shalosh Shudas instead of Sudashli Sheet. This was printed in Venice, the early printings. Here's, let's see where I have a page here. I thought, Oh, here it is. Hold on. No, not here. It's, I want to show you a picture, but in case you're wondering, who says, we don't know about title pages, if Rav Yosef Karo approved and other things of that nature. In fact, the title page I'm going to show you now was written a couple of years after he died, but we have plenty of examples of these sorts of title pages in the lifetimes of the authors. So, here is, 1578, he dies in 1575, and this is what I mean. You can see change in the immutable. You'll see not exactly the most senior type of title page, but we have many examples of that. So I don't know. Look, he didn't see the title page, but the people who put together the title page did what they thought would sell. And we have. You can check out change in the immutable to see other examples of this as well. I just want to confirm it. I said he dies in 1575. Indeed, he does. Okay. The other thing is Rabbi Kama is not with us, but I'll hear it about Rav Yoel ben Nun. Who is Rav Yoel ben Nun? He is not a small person. He's a significant person. You can read about him in Hebrew and English. One of the founders of Yeshiva Haratzion, a very well-respected person. I looked into what I mentioned to Rabbi Kelman, and I remembered correctly. Tamar Ross has an article. Where is her article? Here, the Feminist Discourse, Contribution to Halachic Discourse, Kobe Isha Erva as a test case, and she cites Rav Yoel ben Nun in here. Rav Yoel ben Nun assumes that women's obligation to perform all mitzvot is equal to that of men, following the line of reasoning established by the Rambam and the Magen Avraham. He concludes that women's past exemption from time-bound obligations was due to their being dependent. Their time was not under their control. He assumes that today, since they're not under anyone else's control, they have the status of what's called benot chorin, and the rabbinic concepts of woman that we see in the Gemara don't apply. He also relies upon the Magen Avraham that a woman who voluntarily undertakes the performance of a particular mitzvah transforms its status into an obligation. That's mentioned by the Magen Avraham in Hilchos Sfiras HaOmer. And therefore, he concludes that if a modern benot chorin, that's women, consistently undertake the obligation of regular prayer, they may form a proper minyan with themselves and recite all those blessings that require a male quorum. This doesn't mean that they can be counted in a minyan with men, because either he'd say for snius reasons, because she goes on talking about his opposition to Shira Hadasha type minyanim, or maybe still there's a difference between one who's obligated and one who takes it upon himself. Now, though men are not, according to most, men are not obligated in minyan, but they have an obligation in tefillah that perhaps women don't have. That's the dispute, and therefore they have a different level obligation for tefillah. But in any event, that's Yoel ben Nun. So it's not something in America, it would be crazy. It would automatically be non-Orthodox. But in Israel, things are a little different, as we've spoken about. We will talk later about the ban in Hungary against weddings and synagogues. I mentioned last class, though, that I thought that Rav Israel Hildesheimer, I wasn't sure what his position. I checked it. You can see it in his Gesammelte Aufsätze, his collected, in German and in Hebrew, his collected essays. And he says that this is never mentioned anywhere in the Shulchan Aruch, that it's forbidden to have a wedding in a shul. The Ramah says, Yesh Omrim, there are those who say that the chuppah should be outside, and this was a practice. However, he says, for those who have a different practice, we can't accuse them of any violations of halacha or anything like that. And there have been many rabbanim who permitted this because they didn't want to create disputes. So that's Rav Israel Hildesheimer. And finally, we spoke last class about piyutim. And I mentioned how difficult they are to understand. They are difficult. Try to understand these. Even great scholars, I think, will have a hard time understanding them. Ibn Ezra attacks the Kaliers, Piyutim. So someone asks, so then why do they become popular in our davening? Why do Ashkenazim and Sephardim, why does everyone say Piyutim if they're very difficult to understand? Believe it or not, this very point is taken up by none other than S.D. Shlomo Dov Goitein in his classic book, A Mediterranean Society. I think there's five volumes, and the subtitle is The Jewish Communities of the Arab World as Portrayed in the Documents of the Cairo Geniza. So, lo and behold, in volume two, which is focused on the community, pages 159 on, he asks this very question. And he mentions that, first of all, why are all these piyutim? Why do people feel they need to do piyutim? Are your davenings not enough? Well, there's a pasuk in Tehillim 98, Mizmor Shiru Hashem Shir Chadash, that you should sing for Hashem a new song. So that was a motivation for people to not just rely on the tefillos we have, but to come up with new tefillos. So that explains, but how did they get into our davening? He claims that, he says that tens of thousands, perhaps over 100,000 of leaves covered with religious poems have been found in the Geniza, testifying the stupendous output of the more famous liturgical poets. So why is it included? He says, we wonder who this is written for. He says, first of all, for the scholars, it created an intellectual pursuit to try to figure out these poems. The allusions are so dense. You really need to be a scholar. So this is for the scholars, this creates an intellectual pursuit. But for the masses, he says as follows. It must have been the melodies which with the piyut was sung, which formed its main attraction for the congregation at large and made the long hours in synagogue enjoyable and edifying. So he's tying it to the fact that they, unlike what we did when we were kids, we just read it, but that their songs, the melodies, and that's why he thinks they became so popular. Then he continues, he shows a source in the Rambam that illustrates how enamored the population was with listening to these piyutim, and then he throws in, very interestingly, in parentheses, I understand them, that is the masses, completely. Having grown up in Western Germany, where at the beginning of the 20th century, those songs from the 7th century were still chanted, I can never fully enjoy a synagogue service on a holiday night in the United States or Israel, where perhaps rightly the songs have been discarded. To me, it is like being in a room with walls bare of pictures. It's amazing he throws that in into his discussion about the Geniza. And he goes on to talk about the songs, the tunes, etc. He says that the Piyutim are like crossword puzzles, and they are. Try to figure out what the illusions of all these Piyutim. Now we have nice commentaries that explain it, but it became, I'm not going to call it a game, but an intellectual adventure to try to, yeah, first of all, you often want to make it rhyme, not always, but often. And then you want to have allusions to various rabbinic texts or biblical texts. Just the other day, someone asked me in Shul, he saw something in the Baal HaTorim, and I said, it's in our davening. We say in, well, I don't know if you say it, some people don't say it, in Anizmiros, Rosh Devarcha Emes. Kore Mirosh. What is Rosh Devarcha Emes? So you can just read it that the beginning of your word is truth. And that makes sense, but it's deeper than that because Bereshis Bara Elohim, the last three the letters, the last word, the last letters of the first three words spell Emes. So Rosh Devarcha Emes. Kore Mirosh. That's what it alludes to. I'm assuming that's what it alludes to, but you find lots of examples of that. Okay, let us continue where we are. And I gave an introduction, really, to some of Frankl's ideas, but we're going to pick up right where we left off. And I guess the problem, the question is, how do you find a medium between halacha and history? If you recall, I said that for Frankl, even reforms that are luckily permissible, there's history. We don't reject things that are have a long history, mesoro, if you want to be use that term. So what's the medium between halacha and history? And this is always going to be a challenge. This is the great challenge of conservative Judaism. Solomon Schechter, maybe we'll get to him. He responds to this with his conception of Catholic Israel, Catholic with a small c. Well, they're very similar to what Frankl is going to say, because Frankl anticipates him to a large extent, but Frankl speaks about the folk. VOLK, the folk, the people, the population, the Jewish people. Frankl speaks about how the folk, that is Amcha, the people of Israel, define Jewish practice. What does this mean? The people define Jewish practice. At the end of the day, as Ismar Shorsh in his article on Frankl says, quote, "The ultimate arbiter of the holy was the folk itself. As long as it has a vibrant religious consciousness, it should be seen as a source of indirect revelation." In other words, if you want to know if something is proper, if it should be done, or if it no longer needs to be done, look at the people, look at the folk. And that can determine how Jewish life develops. Now, granted, we're speaking about religious people here. That's going to be an important thing, important aspect, including in the various Rishonim and the Gemaras we're going to see. Frankl once made the point that when you look at the folk, you're not looking at the people who worship the Baal, let's say, in days past. They could even be the majority. You have to look at the religious people, the people part of the community. That's why we've spoken in the past, it becomes so difficult for conservative Judaism, because when they speak about the people, you can't speak about people who are Mechalel Shabbos. So you have to speak about people who are actually fully committed. So according to Frankl, practices can be abandoned, but that's only if over time you see that the people, that is the religious people as a whole, have stopped doing it. Now, what we're going to see, not this class, next class, is I will show you that all these ideas of Frankl, you can actually source them in classical Jewish sources. I'll give you lots of examples. So it's hard to know just in this area, has Frankl crossed, let's say, the Orthodox line? We will see. The abandonment of any practices has to come from the religious sense of the people. That's the problem with the reformers, he said. Even when they're not violating actual biblical halachot, just to get up and for the rabbis to declare that this is no longer suitable. Like, let's say Kriya. Remember we saw that they said that they abolished the idea that you do Kriya. They said it's not dignified. Well, who says it's not? If the masses are still attached to it, see, the reform thought that they can move the masses in certain directions into a more intellectually respectable, progressive type of understanding of Judaism. They saw their goal as to move the masses. Frankl's point is just the opposite. The masses move at their own pace, and then the rabbis sort of can direct things. There can be an ultimate arbiter, but the rabbis are not what's moving. Fundamentally moving matters. It comes from the people. The people move in a certain direction, and the rabbis can maybe, move the train a little bit one way or the other, but it has to come from the people. Practices can only be rejected when the people no longer see it as speaking to them, and that's a form of revelation. And before you say, well, this is so radical, this is reformist itself, to speak about the actions of the people as a form of revelation, I tell you, hold on a minute. Because you're going to see classic sources that say the exact same thing. In fact, for Frankl, by the time the rabbis give their imprimatur on what we might call reforms, or reforms with a small r, it's so accepted among the people that it doesn't really, it's like an obvious step for everyone. This idea of the folk and being determinative in practices, in Jewish practice, Schorsch, in his article, his whole article on Zachariah Frankl, he puts this concept in the German context, where German legalists were using this very sort of argument to try to unify German laws. And I acknowledge that all this is probably true. I also acknowledge that I know nothing about German legal theory, and I take Schorsch's word for it, that the language he uses is influenced by these sorts of ideas. However, Schorsch overlooks in his essay traditional Jewish conceptions, which I submit were no doubt more important to Frankl than German legal conceptions. So yes, you can use German legal conceptions to help you formulate matters, but I'm talking classic rabbinic text. So for instance, what about Minhag Yisrael Torah? It's a classic rabbinic expression that appears in various versions of Minhag Yisrael Torah. Cited already from medieval times that if you look what the people are doing, that's also Torah. Even if you can't source it or justify it, apparently, the fact that they're all doing it, that is Torah. Minhag Yisrael Torah. Kol Hamon K'Kol Shaddai. That's an expression. It's not found in the earlier rabbinic sources, but the last 500-600 years, you see it, that is, if the voice of the masses is the voice of God. And really, even though you don't see this exact expression, the idea is found already in the Gemara. What does the Gemara mean when it says, if you have a doubt about a matter, go out and see what the people are doing, what the masses, it doesn't say ask the rabbis what to do, go see what the people are doing. It's because the people are understood to preserve proper Jewish practice. And although it's not mentioned this way in the Gemara, later people understand it, Rishonim, Achronim, as almost like a revelation that divine will is revealed through the actions of the people. Frankl writes in a passage that you can justify from traditional sources alone, he says, quote, an institution may also have become normative without benefit of higher authority arising from ordinary life. We know that minhagim often arise from the people, not from the rabbis. What does he say? It arises from the piety of the people, which elevate it as a guiding principle, and once it strikes root, it gains permanence. So not only are minhagim and practices developed from the masses, the religious masses, we can give you any number of examples of this, and I will give you some. Practices can also be abandoned. We're going to see examples of this as well, where practices that, if you look in the Gemara, seem to be halacha. And for whatever reason, people stop doing it. If you look in Avelos, what you do when there's various laws of Avelos, I've just been forgotten. I'll give you a number of examples. Turning over the bed, lots of things. I'm going to give you some examples of practices which have just been forgotten or for whatever reason. That's what Frankl's talking about, because the rabbis then justify it. The great Rishonim and Achronim adopt the procedure of what we call Melamed Zchut. They don't understand why this practice is not being practiced. It should be practiced. It's explicit, let's say, halakha. But since no one's doing it, there must be a reason why they're not doing it. And so begins the process of Mohammed Schus to try to find some justification. Because the fact that people aren't doing it means that they must have some justification because they're a pious people. The notion of a Kehila Kadosha means that there must be some justification. Not always. I mean, sometimes you have debate. It is a debate because whereas one rabbi will be Mohammed Schut and will argue that Minhag Yisrael Torah, another rabbi will say, no, in this case, we have to apply the expression that the letters of Minhag is Gehenna. And therefore, we don't want this Minhag. But you see both of them, as we shall see. Mordechai Waxman, leading figure in a conservative movement, he wrote this book called Tradition and Change, The Development of Conservative Judaism. He has an important essay, translation of an important essay from Frankel. The essay is called On Changes in Judaism, or at least that's the translation he gave it. And he goes into this whole idea, again, as I mentioned, that how do you know how things change? How do things change? What's the role of the sages of the Talmud, of the Mishnah, and then the Talmud, the post-Talmudic scholars? He says, for example, that not in vain was the day declared a festival when the Pharisees overcame the Sadducees and ruled that the biblical statement, an eye for an eye, a hand for a hand, was not to be taken literally. What's the reason why? Because it led to the establishment of the principle that the letter of the law is not decisive, but that the spirit must animate the law, et cetera, et cetera. So he goes on citing various sources. He says that what's not accepted by the people of Israel cannot be, is not binding, and what is accepted cannot be changed. He refers to something in the Masechta Avodah Zarah we'll see in a minute. He talks about how Judaism demands religious activity, but the people is not mere clay to be molded by the theologians and scholars. It's not coming from up top. It's coming from the people. He says, when a new ordinance was to be enacted, you have to see if it would be accepted by the people. I'm going to show you what he's referring to in a minute, et cetera, et cetera. And then he says, we've reached a point where when it comes to moderate changes, they must come from the people and the will of the community must decide this. It must be translated, though, into a living force by the people, by the teachers, through the use of ordinances and through interpretation of scripture. So, for instance, if, let's say, the people want something, then it's the job of the rabbis to make it work. Let's say they have to make a gezeira or they'll void the takana, that sort of matter. So the scholars have an important duty to make their work effective. It's to guard the sense of piety of the people and raise their spirit to the height of the great ideas. So you have this cooperation, as it were, between the rabbis and the people. It's the people who are pushing Judaism in different directions, the pious people. The Catholics have a term, sense of the faithful, the sense of the faithful. But the rabbis need to be there because at the end of the day, it could be that the people are doing something which is wrong. So I guess the rabbis do have a veto, or the rabbis can push it in a direction that the most appropriate direction. But the fundamental movement has to come from the people. And generally, we assume that if the pious people are moving in this direction, it's almost impossible for it to be at odds with what traditional Judaism is. And it's for the rabbis to try to, maybe the people are going too extreme, but that's the job of the rabbis, as we shall see. We're going to see a lot of examples of this. So on the one hand, Frankel's approach is conservative with a small c, because it rejects the ability of the rabbis to unilaterally declare, okay, we're going to make these changes or we're going to add these things. You need to respect the will of the people. And how would you determine the will of the people? Well, he says that you would need an elected gathering of communal representatives, and they can express the will of the people. He's imagining a conference, not a rabbinic conference, but a conference of rabbis and lay people who would talk about certain changes that need to make. And that's very different than the reform movement, as we saw. But there's also a liberal side to Frankel's argument. What about practices and institutions that are no longer part of the Jewish community? Here, according to Frankel, they can fade into oblivion. And Frankel admits that, let's say one day, male Jews decided to stop wearing a head covering. They just decided to stop covering that. I don't just mean on the streets and show. That's not halakha, he says. That's something that in theory we wouldn't have to fight over if the people don't want it, or Hebrew. He says that if everyone just has no interest in praying in Hebrew, the whole community as a whole, not for reformist reasons, but if it's somehow developed organically, and I will give you some examples of organic changes that are actually changes of halakha, not changes of minhag or communal practice. The fact is that historically, what Frankel's speaking about has happened in the past. So he's saying that it could happen again in the future. He says, here's another book, Rivka Horowitz, translated into Hebrew, many essays of Frankel. It's called Zacharia Frankel and the Beginning of Positive Historical Judaism. On page 198, she cites a letter that Frankel wrote to the leadership of the Jewish community of Nuremberg. And he says to them as follows, because they asked him, like, here, we're the community leaders. How are we supposed to run a community? He says that we are still bound to so much that we received from the past generations. We can't throw it out. Obviously, we can't be like reformers. He says, however, that throughout the many centuries of Jewish life in Europe, for all the pressure and the difficulties that Jews lived in, certain things came into our tradition which have negatively affected it. He doesn't say exactly what he's referring to. It could be something like maybe kaparos he has in mind. But he thinks that certain things have come into the community that if the people are ready, we can get rid of it. And how do you know when the people are ready? When he says, when you have an understanding that the reason the people want to make changes is not because they want to imitate the non-Jews and not because they're into compromises. Judaism is too difficult the way it is. They want to compromise with the Ruach HaZman, the general atmosphere. No. If the desire for the changes is coming from a religious place, that is, let's say they oppose kaparos because it's coming from a sense of Torah values, namely Tzar Balei Chayim, or some other reason. Now, that's not because they want to look good in the eyes of the non-Jews or anything like that. That's then you know that it's coming from the right place. And if the changes, the reforms of the small r, will be valuable, then we'll do it. This position was adopted by none other than Shom Sharafel Hirsch. If the people want a choir, why do they want a choir? Do they want a choir because they want to imitate the church or because they want to imitate the reformers? No. The Orthodox Jews wanted a choir because they thought it would bring their tfilos, it would make their tfilos more meaningful. It helped in their avodas Hashem. So that's a reform, but that's a positive one. The rabbi puts on this gown. Granted, the idea comes from the non-Orthodox, but their idea wasn't just because they wanted to be like the non-Orthodox. They thought you were allowed to take Chukos HaGoyim or Chukos HaBikursim if it has a good reason. They thought that this would inspire dignity and reverence for the clergyman. It's hard for us to imagine, but so forget the gown, though. Don't we think, at least in many communities, if you see the rabbi, especially in many communities, you want to see your rabbi up there with his black suit and his hat. Because that's the levush, that's the rabbinic garb. Okay, in today's day, and believe me, in Gerba, they don't think that. In the Arab world, they never thought that. They didn't know about these hats. And the Jews in the town of the Beis Hamikdash are not wearing black suits and hats. But that became the levush. So it's the same sort of thing. So you can go down the list. And what Frankel says, that if the motivation for the people is a religious motivation. By the way, Yoel Ben Nun says the same thing about women's issues. He says you have to look at the motivation. Is the motive? And he says the motivation we see today in the community with women is religious motivation. It's they're trying to live the Torah the way they feel the Torah should be lived according to its ethics, etc. They're not trying to tear down. They're trying to build up the Torah, trying to make the Torah more meaningful. That's why they speak about certain things, say certain things should be changed. Not that they want to be more like the outside world, feminism or anything. He sees this as internal. Granted, you have to acknowledge that recognition of the outside world has raised certain issues. But if you talk about, for example, the place of the Aguna, and trying to solve that, this is for religious reasons. It's not anti-Torah reasons. It's Dafka Torah reasons, that a refusal to recognize that, to acknowledge, to admit that the Torah wants women to be chained like that. So, I mean, any suggestion in that area to make changes wouldn't be reforms of a bad sort. They'd be reforms of a good sort to try to make a Kiddush Hashem. So that's what basically the Frankel's talking about. So are there any sources for this idea that he says that the people, ultimately authority is with the people? And yes, we spoke about covering the head and praying in Hebrew, but these are sort of like minhag, not halacha. They're the practice, they're the mesorah. But what about actual law, like literal law? Can we also, would Frankel also apply his approach to the law? And he does. And he cites an example from where the Gemara says, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi says, it says that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi voided, well, here, I'll show you. There are certain things that we don't do because of the non-Jews. Tractate Avodah Zarah 35b says, these are the items, which are prohibited. And what are those? So they give a few of them. We know about milk. Cholavakum. It says the bread of a non-Jew and oil. Now we know because the reason why is it an issue with bread and with milk. So today then you could find perhaps a tearing for that as opposed to cheese. But okay, those two still remain. But then it says hashemen, oil. So there was a decree against oil of the non-Jews. But the Mishnah says, Rebbe Ubeis Dino Hitiru Hashemen, that Rebbe Yehuda Nasi and his court permitted the oil of Gentiles. So the question is, how could they permit the oil? If it was made a decree, you can't use it. How could they permit it? Well, the Gemara explains on the next page that, Rebbe Misharshia says, what's the reason that none of the 18 decrees can be voided, et cetera, et cetera? Hold on. No, that's the wrong thing here. It's the previous passage. Yes. Okay. I think it's here. I can't. I don't have the. Here it is. Rabbi Yochanan said, our sages sat and inspected the matter of Gentiles' oil and determined that prohibition had not spread among the majority of the Jewish people. Okay, so what does that mean? The Gemara says that they looked and it shalop hashat Yisro b'rov Yisro. And this relates to what the Gemara also says, ein gozrin gezera otzibur elim kein rov otzibur yecholei lamoba. So the Gemara says that you don't make a decree on the community unless the community can handle it, number one. You can't make a decree, let's say, that people have to daven, 15 times a day. That's just too much. What we know is that the Beis Din, they investigated it, and they found that this prohibition against Shemen Akum was never accepted by the people. So since it's never accepted by the people, therefore, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and his Beis Din could void it. By the way, the Yerushalmi, parallel text in Yerushalmi, it has a different reading. It doesn't, it says, not Yachol Amodbo, that is, you don't make a gezerah that the people can handle it. It's Ein Rovat Sibor Makabli Nalayim, that the Sibor doesn't accept upon them. I think it's probably the same. I don't know if it's, I think it probably means the same things. Now, this is a classic halacha with enormous implications. Let's look at the Rambam and then talk about some of these implications, because what you're saying here is that the people decide halacha. Okay, here's Hilchos Mamrim, Laws of Rebels, chapter 2, halacha 6. It says, if a court issued a decree thinking that the majority of the community could uphold it, and after the decree was issued, the majority of the community raised contentions, and the practice did not spread throughout the majority of the community, the decree is nullified. The court cannot compel the people to accept it. Beis Din makes a decree, the Beis Din Hagadol, the Sanhedrin, people have to do this, but it's too difficult. It never spreads. That's going to be an important point. The Rambam says, the lo pashta, it never spread in the majority of the community. It is batel by itself. Notice you don't need a Beis Din to void it officially. It's batel. Apparently you don't need a Beis Din. Although the if you recall the Mishnah, it says Rebbe Beis Din Hitiru Hashemin. So that's going to be an issue. Maybe we'll come back to it. And the Beis Din can't force it. Okay, now as we go on, though, think about this for a minute. What does this mean? If the sages make a decree that we have to do something and the people don't accept it, then it's no longer considered binding. Does that means that the people have the ultimate authority, but does that mean that we're sinners for not doing it? So maybe us people who don't accept it, we're sinners, but our sinning makes a fait accompli so that from now on, it's not binding. Maybe retroactively, we're not sinners. The sages say, you have to do this. I say, I don't want to do this. And we all say, I don't want to do this. So I'm a sinner. But then half a year down the road, they see that no one accepted it. So ex post facto, I'm not a sinner. And this could have halachic implications. Let's say I'm a witness to a wedding. If I don't accept her, if I don't accept the authority of the rabbi, I'm also no good as a witness. So you could say that it's not a valid marriage. But then later on, they say that, well, you know, it never spreads. So therefore, do you say ex post facto go all the way to the beginning? I mean, ab initio, it's I'm retroactively a good Jew. Keep that in mind. Now look at Zion. If the sages issued a decree and thought that it spread among the entire Jewish people, and this, in other words, they, in the first case, immediately they saw it didn't spread. Here they issued a decree and they thought it spread. And the situation remained unchanged for many years. It could be 30 years. They thought it was spread. After a long duration of time, another court arose and checked throughout the Jewish community and saw that the observance of this decree had not spread. It has the authority to negate the decree, even if it is of lesser stature than the original court in wisdom and number of adherents. So the first thing is they issue a ruling. No one accepts it. It's void on its own. The next one is, and this is what the Mishnah is speaking about, they issue a decree. It appears to be accepted because maybe in Jerusalem it was accepted, but then, you know, you go out to the heartland, you see that no one's doing it. Then you need the Beis Din. The Beis Din has the authority, Yeshua Rashus Levatel. It has the authority to negate the decree. It doesn't even have to be at the level of the first Beis Din. But notice, I mean, that's also interesting language. We don't have time to get, we can't really go into it now. It has Rashus to be Mevatelet, but it doesn't have to. So that means you're going to have a practice, which most people aren't doing, but at least it's still on the books. And you need it, apparently, here. You need the Beis Din to void it. So that's also interesting. It's not voided on its own. In case you're wondering, what does this mean? Yeah, we're talking about Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin, they're 71. So what does it mean? We understand if it's Pachos mi Beis Din Harishon, we know that it's less in wisdom. We can, I guess, make that judgment. What does it mean in Minyan? Okay, there's a few different approaches to that. The Rambam's approach in this very section, this very chapter, says in 2:2, how is it possible the later court will surpass the original court? For every Sanhedrin has 71 judges. So what does the Rambam say? It means it's referring to B'minyan. The intent is the number of sages of the generation who consent and accept the matter. Okay. One more thing I want to show you about the Rambam. And this is 2:1. It says as follows. When, using one of the principles of exegesis, they darshened, the achas min amidos, kafima shenira beineya, using one of the principles of exegesis, the Supreme Sanhedrin derived the law through their perception of the matter and adjudicated the case accordingly. And afterwards, another court arose, and they perceived another rationale on which basis they would revoke the previous ruling. They can revoke it. As it says in the Chumash, you go to the Shofet that's in your day. This indicates that you only follow the court in your own generation. Chazal, the sages, Beis Din, whatever you want to call it, Darshan is a Pasuk. declares that this is the halacha, a later Beis Din, they can see a different, they can see it differently. They can revoke this. They can reject that drasha. They can give another drasha, and they don't have to be greater than that. Because only down below does the Rambam say you have to be greater. So what would be an example of this? Well, just to give you an example, here's one. Masecha Shvuos. How do we know that women cannot be Edim in Beis Din? I'm talking about, let's say, not Edim, in Edim, not just in Edim, in general, Edim. They derive from a drasha. They derive it from a drasha. And the Gemara explains this drasha. Another, a Beis Din that would arise after this, a Beis Din, let's say in the days of Messianic era, can offer another drasha. And just change. Much of our religion is based on drashot. All these drashot can be altered by a later Beis Din, which means that a Messianic Sanhedrin can really recreate Pharisaic Judaism if it wishes to. In my forthcoming book, I say forthcoming, I haven't sent it into the publisher yet, but I finished it, my book on Rav Kook. I talk about this because Rav Kook focuses on this in a few different places and speaking about how things can change in the Messianic era, that the future Sanhedrin can offer different drashot. And they can offer different drashot just because they feel that this generation, this doesn't work for them. So, for instance, they could say that in this generation, it doesn't work, that women shouldn't be equal to men in this matter. They can offer a different drasha. And that's the way the Pharisees worked. Okay, let's continue now. How does this relate to everything we're speaking about with Frankel? Actually, let me mention a few other points before I do that. I mentioned this in various blog posts, but I'll say it again. Because Frankel's whole point is this valorization of the masses, the religious Jewish masses, that they really run the show. This isn't just something from Frankel, Zachariah Frankel, others. Let me read you, just mention a few others. Those of us in Toronto, you might know the name of Rabbi Yehuda Leib Graubart. He comes to Toronto in the 30s, I believe, no, 20s, I think. A big rav from Russia wrote the Tshuvas Chavalim Ben-Imin. He put the Erev in Toronto. It's the third oldest Erev in North America. The first oldest Erev is in St. Louis, the second is in New York, and the third is in Toronto. But he wrote a book published in 1926 called Sefer Zikaron. And it's talking about the Russian Revolution and the rabbinic attitude and the rabbinic conferences. He quotes Rav Itzel Aponovich, the great Yitzhak Rabinowitz, who says, quote, I'll read you the Hebrew, that, quote, regular Jewish people are more important and exalted than the Torah greats. Here's the Hebrew quote. Ukal Yisrael hu gavoa v'na'ad migdolei haTorah. Kal Yisrael, that is the Jewish people as a whole, is greater at a higher level than the Gedolim. Yisrael im enam neviim b'nei neviim heim. That is, when it says Yisrael, if they're not prophets or sons of prophets, it's not talking about the rabbis. It's talking about Amcha. And this isn't a Hasidic Rav talking about this. There was a Rav in Hartford, Connecticut. Let me show you the book he wrote. The Rav Soloveitchik thought very highly of him. As a Volozhiner student, he wrote two volumes on commentary on the Sefer HaMitzvos, called Yad HaLevi. His name was Rav Yitzhak Simcha Hurwitz. His son was a professor of political science at Columbia University, Jacob Hurwitz, who I spoke to once or twice. And what does he say in his Sefer here? He says that, Ki ha'am bichalam, that is the people, Heim ha'shoftim ha'yoter gevoim b'uma. They are the highest rulers. The kocham yafe betakanot gezerot uminhagim mikoch beitin agado b'chol inyanei adat. And their authority when it comes to rabbinic rulings, takanot gezerot, is greater than the Beis Din, greater than the Sanhedrin. Kol zman she'enam neged haktuvim, as long as it's not, they're not doing anything against the Torah. And what's his source? His source is what we just saw, Hilchos Mamre 2:2, that if the 2:6 and 7, if the people issue, if the rabbis issue a ruling, but the people refuse to accept it, actually it's 2:2. Also, let me show you 2:2. What does 2:2 say? Actually, no, it's not 2-2. 2-2 is talking about how if a court issues a practice and another court wants to nullify it, that it has to be greater in wisdom. That's only if it's a decree, not if it's a if it's from a drasha. But 2-6, like we saw, if the court issues a decree and the community doesn't accept it, then that's it. That's so who's more important? Who's more authoritative? The rabbis or the people? Just what Franco's talking about. Let me also mention a few other examples of this before we see how what Frankl does with this. Chaim Soloveitchik has a famous essay called Religious Law and Change, the Medieval Ashkenazic Example, where he talks about these people in medieval times who committed suicide rather than forced conversion, which itself is problematic. Where do you find a source that you can kill yourself? And they also kill their children, actually, in a number of cases. So Soloveitchik says that, the rabbis had a problem. You're going to say that these people, because they didn't know halacha, perhaps they did these things, but they're suicides. He says, no, listen, let me read to you what Chaim Soloveitchik writes. Quote, the magnitude of this halachic breach is enormous. That is the suicides plus the killing of children. Whether one is permitted to suffer voluntary martyrdom is highly questionable. Suicide is forbidden beyond question, and the permissibility of murder needs no discussion. Thus, if the law were to be followed, the scholars of these communities would have had to rule that all the martyrs, kadoshim, or holy ones as they were called, were not only not holy, but they were self-killers and murderers. That not only should they not be buried with honor, but perhaps they should even be denied burial, or at best be buried in the far end of the cemetery where the most vile criminals are interred. Such a conclusion, needless to say, was an emotional impossibility. In other words, these people, they committed suicide. If the non-Jews are going to kill you, but they committed suicide, they killed children, are we going to say that they're murderers? They couldn't do that because the people were pious people. So the rabbis had to, this is what Soloveitchik's argument is, they had to accept this point. They had to assume, l'chanchila, ab initio, that the... even if we can't find a good justification for it, that these are holy people and we have to justify it, and that God's spirit, providence, whatever you want to say, is in with these people. They're kadoshim. And then he speaks more in this article, Soloveitchik. I call it the sense of the faithful, but Soloveitchik calls it ritual instinct or religious intuition. That's when he gives the famous example, which I've said many times. I'll read it to you. I've quoted it, but I'll read it inside. He concludes with this paragraph. I remember my own shock when, after studying Yoredeya, I realized that there is no need for separate milk and meat dish towels, separate dish racks or cabinets, and that if food is served cold, there is no need for separate dishware altogether. Again, there is all the difference in the world between not having chametz in the house, bal yirah bal yamatzeh, and the house being what we call pesedek. The simple truth is that the traditional Jewish kitchen and pre-Passover preparations have little to do with halachic dictates. They have been immeasurably and unrecognizably amplified by popular religious intuition. We all know this, but our religious sense, our religious experience belies this knowledge, and our instincts reject this fact out of hand. To serve cold cuts on a dairy dish is treif, everything in Yoredeya to the contrary notwithstanding. The prevalent has not here expanded the normative. It is the normative, and anything less is inconceivable. This is very Frankelian. That is, yes, you have the halacha's in the books, but we don't live the halacha in our kitchens. No one would dream of serving cold cuts on a dairy plate. I told you the story about, which Chaim told, I think it was at an RCA convention, when his wife came out of the hospital and she saw the milk and meat plates together in the dishwasher, and she screamed that they're trafing up the kitchen, they're trafing it up. And the Rav said, Shulchan Aruch says it's permissible. And she replied, your Shulchan Aruch is going to trafe up my kitchen. So this isn't something for Frankl to joke about or to laugh about. This is what Masorah is, that it's the people. And just like the people can be led in the direction of greater stringency, and we should recognize this and acknowledge this and respect this, so too sometimes, like with Shem and Akum, it could be led in leniency. And if the people don't do it, well, this is a not divine providence. Revelation also comes out through the people. If they're not prophets, and that is how reforms will happen in Judaism. I'm going to give you another example. After hearing one of my previous talks, which I must have mentioned some similar idea, the Mechaber Sforim, Rav Yonasan Rossman, author of a number of Sforim, including the big sefer on Rav Moshe Feinstein's Tshuvot, in which he goes through all of them, discusses the controversies and the Achronim who agree with Rav Moshe. He sent me a good example of this, how sometimes this the sense of the masses is sometimes, or the people, I should say, the faithful, is independent and sometimes even in opposition to the halakha. Making of a Gadol, Rav Nosson Kamenetsky, page 1188, says as follows. Rav Nosson says, "My father, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, was fond of quoting an interpretation of the Mezhurah Magid, Rav Shmuel Rabinowitz, of the Gemara Masachas Bracha." What does the Gemara say? "Tinor haya tagul lamala mitasel shel David umenagin meilav." A fiddle hung above the bed of King David, and it played on its own. What did the Magid say? "This means that Jewry senses what policy is vital for its existence and doesn't probe whether the course of action or inaction is halachically sound or not. That is, the people know." One of the several examples he gave was by asking rhetorically, "Who gave the Slabodka Yeshiva Bachrim the halachic permission, the heter, to marry at so late an age? They'd marry sometimes 30, 31, 32 years old. Who gave such a heter?" And in answer, he paraphrased the Gemara, which he translated into Yiddish. "Und der Fiddle spielt von sich allein?" And the little fiddle plays on its own. Not a question. "Und der Fiddle spielt von sich allein." The fiddle plays on its own. In other words, that the people made this decision. The Bachrim decided that this is what we need to do. Or maybe the Rosh Yeshiva decided together. In other words, they didn't look for halacha. They didn't need a halacha. They understood that they need a yeshiva and they need students to give many, many years of learning. And that led them, without looking at halachic arguments, even in opposition to halachic arguments. He was out to prove that when some position is of crucial importance to Jewry, such as increasing the number of intelligent Jews getting more years of Torah study before going off into their occupations, halachic minutiae are set aside. Sounds conservative, right? But no, it's Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky saying that sometimes the sense of the faithful tells you, don't come at me with, I actually think this relates to what I quoted 2 weeks ago. Where Rav Yaakov mentioned it's in his sefer, Emes Yaakov, that's where it is, or it's in the biography. They cited him where there were rabbis who said, "Well, if they're not going to do Taras HaMishpacha, we shouldn't make shiduchim and let these Jews marry goyim." Rav Yaakov said that anyone who says this has no das Torah, because here you're getting involved in halachic matters, which are halachic matters, granted, but there's a larger matter that we're going to lose this person. Someone who doesn't know much about Judaism anyway, and Rav Yaakov was very upset with people missing the forest for the trees and going halacha, halacha this, halacha that. But there's an overarching concern which is more important in that case. And in other cases, the cases we just mentioned. So how do you know this? Well, you know this from the people. I'm going to give you some great examples next class, which might blow you away when you see what our Gedolei Yisrael recognized, universally recognized Gedolei Yisrael, what they had to say about practices which fell out of fashion. And that you're confronted with the fact that otherwise pious Jews are ignoring explicit halachot. But before I get to that, I have time for just 2 more minutes or 3 more minutes. I want to raise a question that Franco is also interested in. And I think anyone should be. So we've seen now the halacha and the Gemara. We've seen the side in the Rambam. The Sanhedrin makes a decree, a ruling that all Jews are derabbanan, that you should do this. The people didn't accept it. Either the people didn't accept it immediately, it was obvious, or they thought they accepted it, but really they didn't accept it. What about the Sanhedrin, the rabbanan make a decree? The people accepted it. They were observant for hundreds and hundreds of years, thousands of years. But then in a later generation, they stopped doing it. That is, they stopped following the law. Can that also be voided? Or is it once it's accepted that it's accepted, these are irreligious people? can we void something after it's been accepted? We're going to see in practice that's what happens. Because when pious Jews don't do it, they end up having to find some justification. But I'm not even going there right now. We'll do that in a future class. I'm just saying, according to the Rambam, do we even need to find a limud schos or anything? Or can we simply say that if the pious community, after having followed this practice for 1,000 years, now for whatever reason it's fallen by the wayside, can we say it's no longer binding? And I know that many of you listening are going to be writing to me this week. How can you possibly? Well, you won't, because you're going to hear what I say right now. But you're thinking, if that isn't conservative or Reform Judaism, then nothing is. But I ask all of you, you tell me the Chachamim, who can read Hebrew, please open up the Rambam, Hilchos Mamrim, Perek Beis, Halacha Zayin, and look in the Kesef Mishnah. And listen to what I'm going to read you right now in the Kesef Mishnah. Kesef Mishnah asked a question. How could Rabbi Yehuda Nasi have voided the Shemin Akum? He looks around and he sees that people are not following it. Well, maybe they did follow it. Maybe they followed it for generations, but now they stopped. He says, Im Tomar, Vehechi Samach Rabbi Yehuda Nasi Amasha Badak. How did he know? Dilma Bimeharishonit Mispashet. Vachach Pikbukuba. Maybe the early generations, they all did the Shemin Akum, but now they're not so religious anymore. Umitochkach, because of this question, Haya Nirali, this is where Yosef Karo says, Haya Nirali Lamar, Sha'afilu Nispashta Batrila, Bisrila, even if at first it was accepted, Kevon Sha'akshav Ein Rov Yisrael Noginba, since today most Jews don't follow it, Matirinosa, it can be permitted. Rav Yosef Karo says that based on the Rambam, if there's a rabbinic decree, just think of any decree. Most of what we do in Judaism is rabbinic. The people stop doing it. It can be voided. We need a Sanhedrin. I suppose we have to appoint a Sanhedrin, which they were trying to do in Tzfat. He was given smicha. They could get up and they could just void it and say, well, it's no longer binding anymore because the people don't do it. Then he quotes, however, Rashi, that Rashi has a different interpretation of it, that he says that Rashi sees it, that he examined whether it had ever been accepted from the time, but it does seem that that's not Rav Yosef Karo's opinion. So does this have implications? Because I said you need a Sanhedrin. Well, we'll see. Matirinosa. But maybe there's even more liberal approaches. We shall see next class as we get into it. And you'll see, we're going to get to Rav Kook maybe next class and some other traditionalists. You'll see that they are very similar to Rav Zachariah Frankel's position that basically it's the masses. And then we'll return to Zachariah Frankel, because the argument is that, as we've seen, that yes, reforms are permissible if the community is ready for them and if the community is coming at it in a proper approach. And therefore, you can't say that we can't make changes to the Siddur or Davening. It's hard for us to understand perhaps why there was such a strong response to Frankel, not just about the matters we're going to see, Alchem Moshe Sinai, but this matter. Because the truth is that we are in an era where we've done a lot of these things. Like I said, we've gotten rid of a lot of the kinos. We have music in shul now. We have sermons in the vernacular. We do so many things in the modern Orthodox community in particular. We do all these things that are reforms with a small r. And why do we do it? We do it because we think, like Frankel says, that it's to strengthen Judaism, not to destroy Judaism. And we also feel that the people are at that place today. It's a reform to have a woman get up in shul and give a Dvar Torah. That's a reform, 100%. But we say the people, our people today, we're in a different environment. You know, women are achieve great things. They could be a bank president. Why can't they teach Torah? And so, in other words, we basically, in the modern Orthodox community, and not just the Haredi community also, use many of the same language and approach that Frankel was arguing for. But Frankel was arguing in an era where they would have been outraged. If we brought what we do now back then, they'd be outraged also. So That's what I mean when I say that in practice, much of what Franco was talking about is not just the modern Orthodox world that's very much in tune with it, even in the Haredi world, because I'm not talking about Hasidim, but Litvish Light, Yeshiva Light, they do all sorts of things which could be seen as little quasi-type reforms. But we'll get into more detail with this. We'll show you the Chasam Sofer next week, Professor Blitzstein, and Rav Kook. But let me take the questions and comes. Oh, and Rav Chaim Hirschenson. Because as you can imagine, Rav Chaim Hirschenson is just the sort of person to pick up on this Kesef Mishnah, which I just read, because it opens up all sorts of possibilities. So let me take the question. Justin says that the Shira Chadasha Minyanim require 10 men present. Didn't we hear? I think we heard from Susanna that they try it, but they don't. Or I don't know if Susanna. I know that in my town they tried it, but it didn't work. That doesn't rub me the right way. This requiring 10 men present, because if you want to have a Shira Chadasha minyan, fine, have a Shira Chadasha minyan. But that's sort of like a. I guess it would depend on what Frankel said. Are you doing it because does this come out of Torah that you're trying to create equal dignity, all that? I guess that would be okay. But if it's just about phony equality sort of thing, I don't know. It rubs me the wrong way, 10 men present. If they're not Mechuyev, what are the I don't – what can I say? It's not my thing. Eric says, did Frankel use history only to reject a reform, or sometimes say that practice of a weaker history can be more easily would he sometimes say that a practice with a weaker history can more easily be changed? Well, yes, that's what we're going to see. We already spoke about. He said, for instance, he said we can get together and look at Yom Tov Sheni. He got rid of piyutim. He also brought a choir in. He, like I mentioned today, about if the people want to get rid of prayer in Hebrew, if that really would one day happen, it's hard to imagine. But that's the sort of thing that could change. And really, the conservative movement in its early years was very much in line with this. You have to be where the people are. In Frankel's life, he didn't have real reforms. He's speaking about little things on the edges because they hadn't yet got to real issues. The real issues come only in the 20th century when the people who say that they're the descendants of Frankel have to deal with questions like count a woman to a minion. That's a real issue. But in Frankel's era, Frankel's shul is no different than the Orthodox shul. Maybe they cut out some piyutim. In other words, the difference then was only between reformers getting rid of everything. But the positive historical school, in terms of practice, is no different than the Orthodox in Germany. They both could have choirs and wear gowns. And there really isn't much of a difference, just maybe some little points around the edges. As you get to the 20th century, then assuming, which isn't so clear, that Frankel should be put in this category, but assuming positive historical Judaism merges into the conservative movement, then you see real issues where this idea, the sense of the faithful, is put into practice. The only problem here is that the faithful in the conservative movement were not really faithful to Torah. Today you'll have it. For example, in New York, you'll have the Hadar Minyan, where they're all Shomer Shabbos. And so that would be an example of a conservative grouping where you could really speak about the people. But where you do have it, you have it in the Orthodox community. Without even realizing it, we're going to see a lot of Frankelian type of ideas in the Orthodox world. Because the Orthodox world, you do have 100% Shomer Shabbos, religious, kosher, and yet you still have changes. So then what do you do with these changes? We shall see. Eric says, I think I heard somewhere that the people rejected the idea of a second day of Yom Kippur. They were simply unwilling to fast 2 days. I don't know. I don't know of any evidence that the rabbis wanted to do this and the people rejected it. I think the rabbis knew from the beginning you can't have 2 days of Yom Kippur. But there's been stories, crazy stories about people who wanted to be super stringent who would want to fast the second day. But I haven't heard if anyone actually has anything that this is really the people's rejection. I'm unaware of anything like that.
Rabbi Yossi Adler said that.
Say, okay, well, I need a source.
Yeah.
In other words, it's as far as I know, there's no Gemara like that. There's no Midrash like that. Maybe there's a Rishon who says it. You have to look. I'm going to look at what the Rishonim say about why no Yom Kippur, second Yom Kippur. It could be there's a Rishon who gives that as an example. I don't know. in Shanghai, there was not Shanghai and Kobe before they turned to Shanghai. Some people did observe 2 days of Yom Kippur because of a suffix. They just ate pachos kashir. Cohen says, would kitnios be eligible for retraction on the grounds being discussed? That's an exact example. Kitnios would be something that Frankel's argument, it's a minhag, it's a medieval minhag, it only affects one part of the Jewish community. That's exactly something, and the conservative movement did get rid of it. And this, I'm told that in Israel today, many, many Ashkenazim and the religious Zionists, well, not that the actual kitnios, that is a bean, but they're eating kitnios derivatives in products, because you go to the supermarket, you get it. Now, that's already permitted, according to Rav Yitzchak Inspector and many other Gedolim, the Sridi Yesh and others. So I don't know. It could be that that's not really a retraction, but people who are eating it don't know that there's a terim and that there were Gedolim permitted it. They're just saying that today in Israel, the prohibition doesn't make sense. So kitnios is a perfect example of where Frankel was alive today. He would say, he would ask, are the people getting rid of it because they think it's too difficult, it's a problem, or do they see it as reflecting negatively on a return to Zion, on becoming one people in the land of Israel? Remember, the land of Israel is supposed to be the land of Yosef Karo, his psakim. Maybe we shouldn't be bringing these gullus ideas into the land of Israel. You can go and see the Machon Shiloh rabbi. He has a whole piece explaining why you shouldn't have kitnios in Israel, even for Ashkenazi. But that would be a perfect example of something that Frankel would have in mind.
Rabbi, did you know when you were talking about Piyut, there's a whole book, and I can't remember the author's name, but there's a whole book about whether Piyut is permissible in the first place, whether you can add little that are post-Talmudic. So it's a whole suffix from the start.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. We had a whole class online, one of the early classes on kitnios, by the way. Eli Paso, no, sorry, Justin, the crux of the partnership minyan is a Torah Eliyot, not mixing of genders for constituting a minyan. Correct. And I'll tell you what Rav Ben Nun says about this. He was asked, he says as follows. Hold on. I think Tamar Ross mentions it. I have it here. Yes, he says that in another ruling, Rav Ben Nun expressly rejects any attempt to apply his concept of Benot Chorin, to prayer groups appropriating the model of the Shira Chadasha. Such minyanim use a machitza, but adopt a more egalitarian manner of worship. So he says you can't apply the idea of minyan to them, men and women together. But he also says that he doesn't want women chanting in public. Why? Because of considerations of modesty, arguing that such considerations are to be more stringently applied in the synagogue than ordinary secular activities. So he's opposed to the Shira Chadasha minyanim because the women are singing out loud, things of that nature. Then he says, while he expresses, he says he opposes not only active participation of women in the Shira Chadasha synagogue service, sorry, in the synagogue service, but even a far milder inclusionary practice adopted by Shira Chadasha and a number of Orthodox minyanim on American campuses, namely to wait for the presence of 10 women in addition to the required quorum of men before beginning communal prayer. So we see here that Rav Yoel Ben Nun, he's opposed to Shira Chadasha and waiting for them reading Torah portions and Kabbalah Shabbos, etc., as well as waiting for Although, before those of you who are big feminists find a problem with them, I want to read you what he says also. He was asked a question about halachic matters dealing with women. And this is what Yoel Ben Nun says. I'll read it in Hebrew. Hanashim, talmidot hachachamim, tsrichot la'anot al kach. He says, the women need to respond this. We have women who are talmidei chachamim. Yoter midai rabbanim mitarvim yoter midai ba'olaman shel nashim lamdaniyot. V'harbei kirkulim kvar yatsu mizeh. Mutav shenim shochet yadeinu milikboa. He says, we have women Torah scholars. If you have an issue or deal related to the women, ask the women. They decide it. Moshe Rabbeinu lo pasak l'Miriam ha-Neviyah letzeit im kol ha-Nashim acharea. Moshe didn't tell Miriam that she can go out with all the women. She did it herself. He goes on, he says, whenever this is possible from halacha, let the women decide themselves. Ha'isha ha-Shunamit lo sha'ala et ha'ishela imu matai lalechet al-Isha Elohim. Hikava. That is, the Shunammite didn't ask her husband, do I have to go ask Eliyahu? No, she did it herself. So Rav Yoel Ben Nun is a big believer in women's halachic education, in women rabbis, or halachic authorities. I don't know what he says about pulpit rabbis, but women halachic authorities. However, he doesn't support partnership manyanim, and really the two are totally separate. That's a change in the synagogue. Mesorah, a tradition, which in his mind brings up tznius type of questions. He's from Merkaz, don't forget. Tznius to them is a big deal, pretty extreme, in fact, for many of them. But when it comes to women Torah scholars, he says that women's issues should be a women's matter. Men shouldn't be involved in poskening these shilas. And he has a recognition that women, just because of their psychology, will look at matters differently. Something that most Orthodox rabbis and poskim see this as not just reformist, they see it as casting aspersions on the rabbis. You say that the posek, this rabbi, he can't decide questions because somehow the fact that he's male limits his objectivity. Well, hello, Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun would say, obviously it does, because by definition, men have only one experience. Women have another experience. And that's what he says. And makes a lot of sense to me. I'm not talking about a case here about, whether this is mutsa. You know, a man or a woman, well, they're not going to come to any different conclusions, but there's certain matters where a woman could have certain insights and certain halachot focusing on the men that a female posek wouldn't have the same insights. So Rav Yoel Ben Nun is very cutting edge and very progressive, but it doesn't go so far as to changing the synagogue service. And we only mentioned Rav Yoel Ben Nun because Rabbi Kelman last week mentioned that he has some very interesting ideas, including a new ketubah, which I saw for the first time at a wedding a few weeks ago, where the husband takes upon himself, the wife takes upon herself obligations. It's not just one way. And there's different language about the husband's obligations. And I guess Rav Yoel Ben Nun would say the same thing Shaul Lieberman said when Shaul Lieberman was attacked for his ketubah. Shaul Lieberman said, show me anywhere in the Gemara where it says that you can't make a change in the wording of the ketubah. We know that ketubahs were changed throughout Jewish history. Eli says, during World War II, there were some people in Japan who either did or considered fasting 2 days. Some indeed did. I heard this from my Rebbe in high school, Rav Avram Shlomovitz, who was in with the Mir. Most of the Mirs were already in Shanghai by Yom Kippur. This was September of 1941, but there were some who were not. And I have I documented also in the article I published that there were some who ate pachos kashir. Two more comments, questions. Susanna says, even among the conservatives, there's been pushback on committing kidney oats. At least some are still refraining. kidney oats, interesting, because kidney oats, on the one hand, in America, kidney oats should be something that the conservative movement, if you're really a Frankelian, that's something that became Minhag Yisrael for 1,000 years. So that's something that you should push. In America, to getting rid of it, just as another example of conservative Judaism cutting corners and saying, well, this is too difficult. That's Frankel says that sometimes this approach to history means that we make life more difficult because you can easily justify certain practices halachically, but historically we've taken it upon ourselves, just like we saw Chaim Soloveitchik, that we don't serve cold cuts on a dairy pipe because Judaism is not only halacha. It takes upon the whole, the whole history of what it's become, minhag, mesorah, etc. So it's hard not to look at the conservative getting rid of kidney oats in America as just another example of cutting down, things down on, making it easier and getting rid of minhagim that don't appeal. But in Israel, it's different. Because in Israel, you're in a society that's now majority Sephardic, and there's this whole conception that maybe it's time when we return from the Galut to the land of Israel to try to merge into one. I mean, what, are we supposed to continue for eternity with Ashkenazim and Sephardim, each keeping their own minhagim? Sephardim and Ashkenazim are marrying one another. Does that mean a Sephardic girl then is supposed to give up all her minhagim? And some say Rav Nachman Rabinow said a Sephardic woman can keep her minhagim. But how? Well, you know, it's gonna, what's going to happen in Israel is that a minhag Eretz Yisrael is going to develop. Of course it's going to develop, because there's a minhag Italia, there's a minhag Germania, there's a minhag Aram Sova. Every place in Jewish history where Jews lived, they developed a minhag. So you're going to have a minhag that's going to develop. And in the religious Zionist world, it could be that Kitnios goes by the wayside, but that would come organically, not through just making declarations that because, but it, I mean, I think they say they in the conservative movement that we don't know where this minhag comes from and it doesn't make sense. And if Franco was here, he'd say, what are you talking about? What do we need to know where it comes from? What we know is that for 1,000 years, every single Ashkenazic Jew was Moser Nefesh on Kitnios. That doesn't mean they're Moser Nefesh on Kitnios derivatives. That's a machokas. But to eat beans, no one did. Okay, so Rabbi Shugnow says they say that never took effect in Israel, only in Chutz-Aretz. Yeah, but the question is that what do you do about people from Ashkenazi? We generally assume that Ashkenazim in Israel are supposed to follow the Ashkenazic minhag, but how long? I mean, eventually it'll break down. So Susanna says they say no, it's too difficult because it's minhag shtus. Okay, well again, it's if I was Franco, I'd say it's been our minhag for 1,000 years. All the great rabbis affirmed it. It's not for us to say it's minhag shtus. That's not developing organically. If the religious people on their own, like in Israel, stop following it, that would be one thing. And when I say religious, I don't mean Haredi, I mean religious Zionist. But for the rabbis, by fiat, to say is no longer binding, that's exactly what Franco rejected, what the Reform rabbis did. And let's be realistic here. You can't look at the conservative community and say, well, they're not any kitnios, because you're not dealing with a community that's committed, that's shown that they're committed to halachic observance. So it doesn't apply. Now, as for veggies or vegans, vegetarians or vegans, I know that Rabbi Sperber permitted, I know this for a fact, because I know someone who asked him, vegetarians to eat kitnios. He himself is a vegetarian. I don't think he eats it, but at least I know one person who asked him, and he permitted, this person was from Israel, though, so maybe that also was one of the considerations, permitted eating kitnios because of not much to eat. And finally, from Rabbi Yaakov Yellen, do I think Yom Tov Sheni is heading the same path of kitnios? No, not at all. And all you have to do is look at it. There's been no movement in that direction, no interest in it. And, oh, you mean Yom Tov Sheni in Israel for Americans? Oh, that's already happened. The religious, it's, for some reason, it's become a split between the religious Zionist and the non, and the Haredim. That the religious Zionists, they all do one day. I think, even though there's certainly opinions, the Chacham Tzvi, all of Chabad, Chabad does one day. I think if we're going to be honest, people stopped doing it because it just became too strange. It's easier to do one day, but it's not just it's easier. It became too strange to be in Israel. I haven't been in Israel. And when I was in Israel my year, I kept one day for the first holiday, Sukkot, but by Pesach, I knew I was going home, so I kept 2 days. I asked the Shiloh to Rav Gorin, actually. But I haven't been back for the Chag at all. But today, it seems that everyone I know who goes pretty much does one day, and it's become minhag, I think, of religious Zionist people to do one day. But it does seem that the minhag came about probably because you want to fit in, it looks strange. I don't know if that's the right reason, but it does seem that pretty much now it's my son's in Israel now in yeshiva. And from what he tells me, it's basically uniform that everyone keeps one day in the religious Zionist yeshivas.
There's a well-known rabbi, Orthodox rabbi, very respected, I won't mention names, in LA, who has publicly stated to his congregation that if you go to Eretz Yisrael, you only have to observe one day.
And that's the Chabad. Chabad holds that. And there's important authorities who say that 100%. And that's become the minhag. We have to explore why it became the minhag. I'm only suggesting that maybe it was because more of the convenience factor and the strange factor that what are you doing? You're observing this when no one else is. It's a little weird. Okay, everyone. Thank you all. I don't know if Rabbi Kelman is here.
I am here. Yeah, I was back the last 15 minutes or so. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Wednesday, I mentioned Rabbi Ben Nun. I began with Rabbi Ben Nun.
Yeah, I heard you. What you said about Rabbi Ben Nun and the Nuksuva. Yeah, I got in a few minutes before that.
No, at the beginning. At the beginning. About women and the men, about women taking upon themselves Mrs.
Oh, no, I missed that. I wasn't here. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay, we can talk about that. Dr. Shapiro is going to be in Toronto this Shabbos as Torah Motion will be having its first scholar in residence live in since February of 2020. So it's a pleasure to welcome. He'll be speaking for those that are in Toronto. He'll be speaking many times.
I have to say,
over Shabbos.
Rabbi Kalman, it turned out very lucky because the fear was my daughter is supposed to.
I know.
Give
I know.
Birth, and if she gave birth on Shabbos, then the bris would be on Shabbos. She gave birth yesterday.
Oh, that Baruch I didn't Hashem. Know.
So the rest is Sunday, tov. So all the more reason why I have to come on Saturday, Motzei Shabbos. So,
right, good. Yeah, we planned that anyway.
My providence is ensuring that I can come to Toronto and it'll
right.
be a nice day.
Very nice. Speaking on many talk, but I'll just say one story I imagine. I remember Rav Schechter told us that many years ago, Rav Charlap was invited to go. He was like Rav Cook's shamus, basically. That's the Rabbi Charlap from YU, his grandfather. Yeah. So he was invited to go with a group of Americans to Tzfat, and they were going to keep a second day Yontif. And Rav Cook got very upset at them. He says, in Eretz Yisrael, you know, how can you keep 2 days Yontif? And he didn't want him to go. He was going to be the Mashkiach, I don't know, whatever. And he said that he needs the money, Parnassus. So Rav Cook said he could go on condition they play music. That on the second day Yontif, that the Americans should know it's not really Yontif. No, they want to do no malacha, but they should play music for them a little bit. But you're 100% right. When I was in yeshiva, I kept a day and a half. That was the worst of the worst, but that's what we did. Today, everybody keeps one day. Came out everybody. The last time
I asked my son to ask Rav Schechter because someone told me the other day that he's heard, again, it needs to be confirmed, that Rav Schechter has now changed his position, has been telling people one day as opposed to day.
Well, I'm not surprised because
I have not heard that though.
Rav Schechter used to hold 2 days plus, they called it 2 days, but you had to put on tefillin. He said you should keep 2 full days with Kiddush, regular 2 days, but just in case you should put on tefillin. Tefillin is a din d'oraita, so you shouldn't give up to like tefillin. That's how he used to paskin. But when I was in Ashir many years ago, I remember him saying that the idea of one day is becoming more and more popular. I remember him saying that, you know, halakha sort of goes through this evolution.
You ever wonder though why the Shulchan Aruch doesn't have this law? It's not in the Shulchan Aruch. You think this is
the Shulchan Aruch says 2 days, I believe.
It's in the Tshuvas of Yosef Karo. About the difference between yeshiva students and not, but it's not in the Shulchan Aruch. You think this?
No, I'm not
saying
yeshiva students. He was just saying in general, the minhag was moving. You know, it was becoming more popular to keep one day. The problem is, of course, that if you keep one day when you go to Israel, the Americans, the Israelis who come to Chutz Lars should keep actually 2 days, and a lot of them don't do that.
They definitely should.
To be 100%. Consistent. And that is the basic halacha. Those who are Talmidei Chachamim know that when you come from Israel, you really can't do malacha on the second day at all. But that would be fair. You go to Israel, you keep 1 day. That's everybody does. But then when you come to America, you have to keep, of course, 2 days if you're visiting after you made all
the time. Schechter holds that you can fly to America from Israel on the second day and stay in the airport. I'm told
that's a different question. That's a different.
You take a cab then after. No, but I say there's nothing in the Shulchan Aruch about travelers to Eretz Yisrael what to do on the Chag. That's very unusual. You think he would have put it in the Shulchan Aruch? He has a tshuva on it, but it's not in the Shulchan Aruch.
You know how many people travel to Israel for Yontif? You can count them on one hand. You know, I every year I get very upset. You know, when we have for 3 months this year that we were off on the Parsha because of the Shabbos and we didn't make up the Achrei Mot Kedoshim, we waited to Matat Masai. I would say probably affects a million people. At least a million people were impacted by hearing the wrong parsha. The one parsha twice and one parsha they didn't hear at all. At least you calculate how many people travel back and forth in a 3 month period from Israel. It's like a million people. And knew when the minhag developed which parsha to double up, and they said we'll double up Matat Masai for all kinds of reasons, not Achrei Mot Kedoshim. Maybe 2.5 people were affected every year, and that's probably an exaggeration. It's probably less than 2 people. How many people traveled from Chutzla? Like in the 1200s? Okay. Like you can count them on your, you know, on one finger. So I've advocated, this is a reform I would push for, you know, much, but that's why this doesn't happen. You know, we should move the parashiyot in sync. I think it looks really bad when we're reading different parashiyot, but that's my pet peeve. And Mark, you'll tell me why I'm wrong. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, everybody. A pleasure. For those who are tomorrow, Nava Finkelman continuing her series on foreigners in 11 a.m. And Rabbi Shulman is fascinating talks on Sefer Daniel. And this week, Shuli Mishkin is back after being away last week. And Rabbi Shulman, who's giving the class on Daniel, is giving actually this week's Tavshir on the Parsha. So that'll be 8:30 Thursday. And then Wednesday, Natty Helfka, Neiman Nevetsky, and Meisher on the Siddur on Friday. So we look forward to learning with you. Please invite a friend. And okay, Dr. Mark, I don't know if you're still here, but Mazel Tov on behalf of all of us. And everybody be well. And we look forward to learning with you soon. Okay, Laila Tov, everybody. Thank you.
Laila Tov, Toda Rabah.
Toda.
Mazel Tov.